Welcome to the Chicago Jazz Audio Experience Podcast Network. This is Mike Jeffers, Chicago Jazz Magazine, chicagojazz.com. And on this Throwback Thursday podcast, we're going to dip back into the vault to December 2014 from the Chicago Jazz Revealed show we used to do up at Katarina's on Irving Park Road here in Chicago. We're going to sit down with Bobby Lewis, the legendary trumpeter who has recorded, performed on over 7,500 different recordings, from jingles to full studio recordings and many other things. He also worked with Peggy Lee and Tony Bennett, and the list goes on and on. But I'm going to let Bobby tell you all about that on this Throwback Thursday podcast. Hope you enjoy it. Let's get to it. Welcome to Chicago Jazz Revealed. I'm Mike Jeffers. We are live at Katarina's, 1920 West Irving Park Road here in Chicago. The crowd's filing in. Of course, we record here at Katarina's every Tuesday night from 7 p.m. to 8 p.m., where we feature, well, I guess we just want to reveal who's on the jazz scene. I know I've heard from a lot of different listeners over the past couple of months we've been doing the show as far as how they've actually discovered new musicians on the scene and of course, gotten to know old favorites. And I think today we have an old favorite, not old, but
real old.
Trumpeter Bobby Lewis is here, and we're going to be talking about his career and his new release and his upcoming shows and everything else he's got coming up here at the end of 2013 and 2014. How are you, Bobby?
I'm doing just great. Good. Got back from Florida, and it's cold up here, I'll tell you.
Yeah, well, I'm sure it's a shock to your system, actually, walking into this. When did you get back?
Last Wednesday.
Now, you go down to Florida a couple times a year, don't you?
Well, usually in January, one time in November, and then in January for about 4 or 5 weeks.
Do you play gigs down there, too, or just...
Well, my friend Jim Ryan usually goes down there in West Palm Beach, and sometimes he has a gig or two, but...
Yeah, he manages to go down there and actually plays, like, regular gigs and stuff down there, doesn't
he? Kind of regular.
Kind of regular?
If anything's regular anymore, you know. But, yeah, I do a few here and there.
Yeah. But you've been based out of Chicago since you got started, right?
I mean... Well, I came here in 1961.
Okay.
With Dave Remington.
Oh, okay.
And we were playing at a place called Cafe Continental, which was in Walton and Rush.
Okay.
You know, in a basement. It was Jimmy Allegretti's joint. And I like to say that I started in the basement, and then I started recording two floors up at Universal, which was in the same building.
Oh, that was in the same building?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Now, first of all, Dave Remington, that's a name that I know, and I'm sure a lot of our listeners remember. Dave, he was a drummer, wasn't he?
No, Dave was a piano player and a trombone player.
Okay.
His father was a trombone teacher at Eastman School of Music in Rochester.
Okay.
And Dave came from a family. His mother was a organist, and his sister played harp in the Pittsburgh Symphony. And Dave was the black sheep of the family. He played jazz piano. But
now, how did you end up? I mean, was that a touring band that you were in, or he called you and brought you into Chicago?
Well, actually, the way I met Dave was I was had just graduated from the University of Wisconsin with a master's degree in trumpet, and I got fired from my jazz gig there, and Dave called me. He says, Jack Teagarden was around, and I had sat in with Jack when he came to Madison. And he said, I talked to Jack Teagarden because I need a trumpet player for 5 nights. And Jack says, well, this kid up in Madison can really play, you know. So Dave called me for 5 nights, and it was magic. Chuck Hedges was on the band.
Oh, wow,
And Joe Levinson was playing bass and a few other guys. And Dave called the regular trumpet player that was supposed to come in and says, don't come in. I got a guy. I'll pay you two weeks. And then I got drafted, and Dave helped me through a friend of his who was a legislative assistant to Vice President Nixon. And they got me to Germany, the 7th Army Symphony and 7th Army Band. And then when I got out, I rejoined Dave and and came to Chicago here.
So backtracking a little bit, you went to school at University of Madison, University of Wisconsin-Madison, and you got your master's in trumpet, so you stayed, were you there all 6 years or 5 years? Or
well, it was 5 years, and I did a performance, a recital.
Okay.
So I didn't have to write a thesis because I didn't think I could do that. Just give me the horn and let me play. And I played the Haydn trumpet concerto and the Hindemith trumpet sonata and in another sonata, all in one concert.
Oh, my God.
It was a real undertaking, and I kind of wiped myself out. And I played my recital on my night off for my jazz gig. I didn't want to lose the $15, you know. Oh, boy.
So right then and there, you were already thinking as a jazz musician.
Well, I could play jazz and classical. Yeah. You know, I could play the whole realm, you know, because I played in a university symphony orchestra, and I played solo cornet, the hot seat in the symphonic band.
Mm-hmm.
And we had several jazz groups around, and that's actually when I started playing the flugelhorn.
Oh, okay.
In college.
Okay. Is that a more classical instrument? I mean, is that something you would pick up as a classical musician as opposed to, you know, if you're a trumpet player and playing jazz?
Well, as it turned out, the conductor of the band, Ray Dvorak, we were doing a Russian piece that called for flugelhorns, and he said, I want the cornet section to go down to the band room after rehearsal and check out a flugelhorn. I got some old flugelhorns in the band room there. Mm-hmm. So I was the first one down there because I wanted to get the best one there because they were all dogs except this one that was kind of rotary valve. And I took it on a jazz gig a couple nights later, and, boy, it felt great, you know.
There wasn't a lot of people playing flugelhorns back then, were there, with jazz gigs, really?
Well, I think Miles Davis started Birth of the Cool. I think he played what was called a flugelhorn, but his flugelhorn sound really wasn't actually really typical of a real flugelhorn sound, although it says on the liner notes that he did use a flugelhorn. Mm-hmm. So, but one of the great proponents of the flugelhorn was Art Farmer.
Right.
Of course, Clark Terry, you know, two of the great players.
Yeah.
And I don't know exactly when they started, but when I came to Chicago in 1961, Johnny Howell, Warren Keim, and Art Hoyle, and all those guys were playing the flugelhorns.
Okay.
So it was a kind of a movement here in Chicago.
Oh, okay.
So we were, in fact, Warren Keim started a band called the Brass Impact, which was five trumpets, six trumpets, including himself, doubling on flugelhorns, two trombones, one reed, and two singers, Donna Keim and Joanne Judson.
Wow.
And it was called the Brass Impact. And it was pretty amazing, the sound you can get with six flugelhorns.
It's and he must have written the arrangements for everything. And put
he wrote some. I wrote some. Yeah. A lot of guys wrote arrangements for it.
Yeah.
But it was a pretty amazing sound.
You know, I guess when you left Madison, I mean, where'd you grow up? Where did you?
Well, I was actually born in Wisconsin in Oshkosh.
Okay, so it was a natural progression to go over to the University of Madison then? Or?
Well, it was. It's the most inexpensive tuition. In-state tuition was $60 a semester.
Oh, jeez.
And I was living in a room that cost $7 a week.
Oh, man.
You know, so my education didn't cost much, you know, because my folks didn't have much money. And, of course, I didn't have much money either.
Right,
you know.
Right.
I wasn't even playing many gigs because nobody even knew who I was around that time.
I mean, were you, when you were coming up out of high school and stuff, you played, was there a jazz band in the high school you were at?
I did.
Is that how you got started with
my
jazz?
My uncle was the conductor of the high school band, and there was a jazz band that we had playing all these little octavo stock arrangements you know, Les Brown and Glenn Miller and all those big band things. And I kind of had a natural proclivity for improvisation. I would listen to Harry James records. My dad had some Harry James 78s And I would try and copy, figure out what he was doing, you know, by my ear.
Okay. And then, so you didn't really sit down and
try it out.
With the theory and stuff at that point, you were just kind of going by your ear and hearing what the chord changes
exactly,
were.
Exactly, you know. And my dad helped me start a band when I was 14, you know, and playing dance jobs and stuff and learning all that, those tunes, those great old tunes that are called, what are they called now? War horses or, you know, or oldies. And stuff like that, but there's still some great songs that were written like 80 years ago, in fact, that are still played.
Yeah. Well, so you did that, and then you just decided, and I mean, because what wasn't the natural progression, especially at that point, was to, like, go to a big city and start playing gigs or trying to get into the scene as opposed to going to college back then? Or
well, my uncle and my dad insisted I go to college because I wanted to go on a road, you know.
Yeah, right.
I wanted to join one of those territory bands and play one-nighters and, you know, all that stuff.
Right.
And, you know, and they said, no, go to college and get an education because then you always got something to fall back on. Mm-hmm. And then after I received my bachelor's degree, they said, go ahead and get a master's degree.
Was it an education that you got?
Well, the bachelor's was in music education, and the master's was in applied music.
Okay.
Trumpet arranging and conducting is what it amounted to,
okay,
to be.
Well, and going through college and doing all that, then when you moved to Chicago, and I know that at the time in Chicago, that's when there were like the 5-6 night a week gigs everywhere, right?
Right.
Rush Street.
Well, in the meantime, I had gotten drafted. I had to spend 2 years in the Army.
Before you came to Chicago.
The only war at the time, it was between the Korean and the Vietnam War.
Mm-hmm.
But the only war at the time was between me and the Army. Bobby Lewis versus the United States Army.
Did you win?
No.
Okay. I just want to make sure. So you ended up going from college, and then you got drafted right when you came in town and met Dave Remington, and then you were out of here.
Yeah, right, right.
And that's when he pulled some strings. You ended up in Germany. But that background that you had in college probably really helped, because it sounds like you were in the bands in Germany, right?
So well, I had gone over to be in the Seventh Army Symphony because I was going to be a classical player at the time. But the opening never occurred. I passed a couple auditions, but there was never an opening for me. So I was in the Seventh Army Band, which was a post band, you know.
Okay.
One of the main bands.
Mm-hmm.
And there was five guys and tenor player to play like Coltrane and a drummer, bass player, and a piano player and stuff. And we got to play and entered the Army Entertainment Contest and won all the levels up to the European finals, and we got second place there. But we went on a three-month tour.
Now, where were they? Would they send you into the war zones and stuff?
No.
No,
I was in the band, no.
They didn't want to hear any jazz in the jungles or anything.
I would just practice 4 hours a day, actually.
Really?
You know? Yeah, there's not much. But it was such a farce, I could have got court-martialed a couple times, maybe more than that, you know. But
you were stationed in Germany then.
Yeah.
And did you meet a lot of American musicians, like, coming through, like, you know, doing different things? Or
not really, no. And it wasn't, we didn't meet any touring musicians or anything like
right.
that.
Well, so yeah. I've got to find out, because I've always been curious about this, because you're not the only person I've talked to that was in the Army band or in a Marine band or something.
Mm-hmm.
What do you do? You just rehearse 4 hours a day and then...
Well, you rehearse and you play commanding generals or authorities that come on the post, or you play at different functions and, you know...
And that's it? You pretty much just hang out then and you're there?
Well, yeah, you know, argue. It was pretty easy duty, but...
So you were there for 2 years, and then you came back to Chicago.
Well, actually, I was there in Germany, actually, for 14 months, because I had to do basic training And
oh, they made you do that, though, right?
Well, yeah, it was called band training in at Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri, which was...
Well, so you didn't have to do all the running and jumping and push-ups and all
that stuff? Well, I had to do... Yeah, I ruined my hearing in basic training with the thing they called night maneuvers, you know, where grenades would be exploding, explosions, and machine gun bullets over your head and stuff like don't stand up, they said. Well, yeah, right. Don't stand up, you won't come back, you know. But all that, and, you know, I got severe tinnitus or tinnitus from that experience.
Oh, wow.
Thanks to the U.S. Army, you know. But anyway, I got out 3 months early and went back to the University of Wisconsin for a semester. Actually, I went back there so I could get out three months early.
Right, yeah.
And then that's when I came to Chicago after
that. Okay, all right. Wow, I never even knew that you have tinnitus in your ear and stuff.
Yeah,
still.
Since I was 22 years old.
Does that affect your trumpet playing at all? I mean, does it...
What? Well, it's...
That was too easy.
Yeah, right. I have this ringing, of course, all the time.
Yeah.
And I've always sat next to the drummer in a big band, you know, with the cymbal.
Well, they're quiet, aren't they? And all, drummers are pretty quiet.
Yeah, right. Tell me another thing, Mike. And then having the headphones on for all the sessions I ever did,
sure.
You know, with click tracks and all that might have affected my hearing. But I guess I'm fortunate to have as much left as I do,
yeah.
You know.
Well, when you came back to Chicago and talking about sessions, and that's where I was going to ask you about, is that you came back, and, I mean, there were those 5-6 night-a-week gigs, so you're doing that. But the recording industry was really happening in Chicago at that point, too, right?
Well, that's for sure. It was really starting to really climb, and I was fortunate to get some calls.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, one of the first calls I got was for Dick Marks, whose son is Richard Marks.
Yep.
You know,
he was a big contractor in town, right?
One of the biggest.
Yeah.
And I was called, and afterwards he said there was about 3 minutes left, and we had this 2-minute piece to do. And he said, "I want to make some corrections, but don't write it down because, you know, we don't have time.
Mm-hmm.
Just remember it, so get the corrections." And then we recorded it. And right at the end, I picked up my pencil for no what reason, I don't know, because the trumpets weren't playing, to make this correction in the music that would never be used again.
Mm-hmm.
And just as it's the silence at the end, you know, where they need the ring out, it's called?
Yeah.
I had dropped this pencil and went click, a clank on the music stand. And Dick Marks and expletives said, "What was that?" You know, and everybody looks at me, and of course we had to do the 20 minutes overtime, 18 musicians, and I caused that, you know. And I thought, boy, I started my recording career and ended it on the same day.
Right.
But I got a call later, and
I mean, how do you even break into the recording scene at that point?
It's you earn a reputation, you know. Johnny Howell, I had played with him some gigs and stuff with Tex Beneke, Sketch Henderson, and, you know, different shows.
Mm-hmm.
And he called me, you know, said, "Can you make it?" So that's how it was. They trusted the fact that I could play it.
Mm-hmm.
And don't market yourself, or you didn't then.
Right.
There was no, you know, it was all by word of mouth
and
recommendations.
And the fact that they knew that you could play,
And the success you had was the reason you got called back.
Yeah.
And I ended up doing 7,500 recording sessions.
Oh, jeez.
TV, radio commercials, and record dates, and I did all Curtis Mayfield stuff, and you know, Leroy Hudson and Donny Hathaway and Natalie Cole.
Mm-hmm.
He produced all those great recordings.
Well, let's take a breather and let's listen to one of your recordings.
Okay. Can I say something about this?
Yeah, I was going to ask you. What are we going to hear?
It's a new CD I've just recorded, and it's not out yet. So these are just the final mixes. And this first track is written by Joe Bell, great Chicago singer who lives in Las Vegas. Mm-hmm. And she used to call me Bubala. And I said, well, my name is Babalu, you know. Yeah. Some people call me that. I said, why don't you write a tune called that? So she wrote this tune, and we recorded it, and this is the result that you're going
to
hear.
All right, well, let's take a listen here to Babalu. No, I said it wrong, didn't I?
No, you said it
right. No, I did.
Babalu.
Babalu. On Chicago Jazz Revealed, 90.9 FM, WDCB, chicagojazz.com.
Swinging the blues, went to Paris with nothing to lose. Pulled out his trusty horn of gold. His musical story was soon to unfold. The Eiffel Tower couldn't get him that high. Parisians cried when he said goodbye. Chicago smiled when he came back to town. It's never the same when Babalu's not around. Singing and playing with mellifluous tones, like the warmth of the sun that just gets into your bones. The crowd went crazy when he started to play. They knew that Babalu was home back in Chicago to stay. Babalu! Listen how he blows. Babalu! Everybody knows. Flugelhorn and trumpet too. The cat knows what to do. Babalu! What a guess! Every note, a master class. Here's some jazz to get you through. Play it, Babalu. Smiled when he came back to town. It's never the same when Babalu's not around. Singing and playing with mellifluous tones, like the warmth of the sun, it just gets into your bones. The crowd went crazy when he started to play. They knew that Babalu was home back in Chicago to stay. Babalu! Listen how he blows. Babalu! Everybody knows. Trumpet too. The cat knows what to do. Babalu! What a guess! Every note he blows, it's a master class. Here's some jazz to get you through. Come on, play it! Play it, Babalu! Thank you.
All right, we're back here at Chicago Jazz Revealed. Of course, I'm sitting here with Babalu himself.
Babalu. The crowd is Babalu.
Bobby Lewis here. We're live at Katarina's, 1920 West Irving Park Road here in Chicago. And you're listening to Chicago Jazz Revealed. I'm Mike Jeffers. And we were talking right before we went to the track, and I'm going to let you pronounce the name of the new album, because it's going to come out at some point in the next couple of months, but I'm going to let you call it. What's the name of the album?
Mellifluous Tones.
That's what I said.
Just sing Mel F. Lewis.
Oh, Mellifluous. I can remember that.
Mellifluous.
And, of course, all of that is will be available. And, of course, what do you have like 12 CDs currently, and then this will be the 13th, or is that?
No, this will be the 11th. Actually, this is the 9th in this series because I have two reissues.
Okay.
One was the trumpet group I had in the 70s called The Forefront.
Mm-hmm.
And the other was with the Rhythm Makers, who they were the Friday night band at Andy's for 15 and a half years.
Oh, wow.
Barrett Deems is on drums, yeah. And, you know, Chuck Barham and those guys, Eddie Johnson, mm-hmm. Eric Schneider.
So what's the name of the website? What's your website?
BobbyLewis.com.
Oh, that's easy. Okay. I can remember that. I wasn't
well,
sure.
Well, you, I can't sometimes.
So all of that information, of course, where Bobby's going to be performing. He does have a couple shows coming up. December 13th and 14th at Andy's, and you'll be doing the early set from 5 to 8:30.
Right, because I can't stay up that late.
Yeah, right.
1:30 is, I'm a pumpkin by then. You know.
So that's December 13th and 14th, and then you're also at the Jazz Showcase the weekend of January 2nd through the 5th of
correct.
2014 at the Jazz Showcase. Both shows, is that going to be with your quintet?
Well, actually, the Andes is a quartet.
Quartet, okay.
Myself and Jim Ryan, Stuart Miller, Ernie Adams on Friday, and Paul Wertico on Saturday.
Oh, okay. And then and showcases the quintet or the quartet again?
The showcases with Pat Mellinger and Jeff Stately.
Oh, great. And that's the regular band. That's usually who you perform with, right?
Those are the guys I've recorded with quite a bit, you
mm-hmm.
know.
Mm-hmm. Well, and also before we went to the tune, you laid on the audience that you just happened to be on 7,500 recordings. And then we went to a break.
Yeah. So, well, it was during the years in Chicago, or actually the recording years around the country, mm-hmm. everywhere, when you could call yourself a studio recording studio musician.
Right.
But that's disappeared.
Yeah, I mean, everybody wants to be. I remember when I was coming up and everybody was going to school, and I said, well, what are you going to do? Oh, man, I'm just going to be a studio musician.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I had a student come to me one time. He says, I want to break into the recording studios. I said, oh, really? You know? He said, yeah. I said, your teacher told you that paid the most money, right? He said, well, yeah. And I said, well, nobody breaks into the recording studio. I said, you get earn a reputation and you get recommendations from your peers. And I said, if you're a trumpet player, I'm your competition. and he about froze with that one. I said, well, you know, I don't call the producers; they call me. So
right. Right. I thought you were going to say, well, the only way to break into a recording studio is after everybody leaves.
Right. Right. Break the door down.
So, I mean, during that time in Chicago and everywhere, but it wasn't Chicago one of the main places, one of the hubs of, like, doing all the jingle work and doing the recording stuff at that point?
The jingle work, yeah. We were right with New York as far as the amount of recording it was done. And one of the reasons was the singers that we had here, Bonnie Herman, Don Shelton, and Gene Perling, Len Dresser, the Singers Unlimited, in fact. Mm-hmm. They were all here, and Bob Bowker, and great singers. And a lot of times they would come and record commercials here because of those people, especially Bonnie Herman,
yeah.
who was exceptional.
So, I mean, and once you got into that scene, then you were just like the first call guy probably when they needed trumpet.
One of them, yeah.
One of them, mm-hmm. yeah.
In fact, all those I told you I did, I had to turn down, a lot more than that.
Wow.
If I could have done them all, I would have probably done 15, thousand, you know.
It's amazing.
I mean, yeah, you'd get a call and you'd get two or three calls for the same time. I can't do it because I'm busy.
Right.
You know.
Well, what I mean, I know that a lot of our listeners, I mean, obviously they've heard a lot of different recordings. Probably have heard a lot of recordings you're on and don't even realize the ones that you're on.
Well, one of them is the American Breed, mm-hmm. Bend Me, Shape Me. Mm-hmm. It's a big one of their biggest recordings. And the Buckingham's kind of a drag.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I was in that. That's you have to be older to remember those kind of recordings. But a lot of them I can't even remember. Dale Clevenger called me one time. He says, "Can you make a session at RCA?" It was on Wacker. He says, "It's just flugelhorn and French horn. It's for Alice Cooper."
Oh, really?
So, oh, okay. You know, so we go up there and we record this track and hand him our slips and leave. I don't know if he was even there. I didn't, you know. But that's the kind of thing we did. You
and
know?
That's how it was, right? I mean, mm-hmm. you'd walk in at noon and record something, and then you might not ever hear it again or not even know what happened or whatever, and that was it, right?
Or do another one at 1:30, another one at 3 o'clock, and you couldn't even remember the one you did at 1. So, you know, I mean, it was, you know, right from one to the other. And,
was a lot of this stuff arranged? I mean, were the charts written out and everything?
Most all of it. In fact, later on, a lot of times I'd go in and they didn't have any charts, you know, any arrangements.
They just give you an idea what
figure
they
out
wanted.
This and put something in there and do that. And,
yeah.
Oh, okay. You know, I played on a garden hose a couple times. And,
oh, really?
And played just my mouthpiece and... Some really weird stuff, I'll tell you.
Well, you also played with a lot of touring musicians too, right? When they would come through town, or you got picked up on some of their bands and things.
Well, not necessarily the bands, but all the big stars that would come in and need a band,
mm-hmm.
need an orchestra, like Peggy Lee. I always played with her when she came to town. In fact, I had a chance to be her music director for a couple times.
Right, I was going to ask you because you got to know her, right?
Very well, yeah.
Yeah.
She was a great friend.
I mean, were you traveling with her, or was it more?
No, I played, I conducted for her in St. Louis at the Westport Playhouse, and then in Toronto at the Royal York Hotel there on two different shows. But what she really needed was a piano conductor. Larry Novak was. Before I was.
Oh, okay.
And she used Lou Levy a lot in years before that. But, you know, a piano conductor mm-hmm. was what she needed more than a trumpet playing conductor. But,
right. How did you become friends with her? I mean, you know, a lot of times you'd probably get hired for a job and then that would be it, but you ended up making a connection with her and becoming friends with her and stuff?
Well, I first played for her in 1967 at the College Inn at the Sherman Hotel okay. when they were having shows there.
Mm-hmm.
And every night was a party. I mean, you know, party in the room, party in the...
Really?
In this, you know, her dressing room on the stage or whatever. And it was just natural, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then Johnny Howell and Art Hoyle and I went to catch her opening after that at the Waldorf in New York. Now, that was a real trip.
Yeah.
Peggy Lee's opening at the Waldorf Astoria in New York was a big deal. In fact, Tony Bennett was in the audience. He came in a tuxedo. People wore tuxedos and gowns and all that.
Mm-hmm.
It was pretty amazing
yeah.
to see the respect that she always got, you know.
Well, that would be amazing, too, just to be on the other side of it because, I mean, you're hanging out with her, so you're seeing the people come up to her and seeing their reaction.
Yeah, I know. And then I was one of the regulars that she always wanted, you know, every time she came and played here in the
yeah.
city.
Did you ever do anything out of town with her? I mean, other than Toronto and St. Louis?
No, actually not.
Hang out in L.A. or anything?
No, she'd grab a band where she was playing, you know.
Now, another person that you got to know was Doc Severinsen, wasn't it?
Yeah, I got to know Doc very well, yeah.
Because you've done stuff with him, I think, at Ravinia
mm-hmm.
and,
right.
and things
mm-hmm.
like that.
Yeah.
How did that connection happen? Was it when he was already on the Tonight Show band
well,
or before?
I don't know. It's... You got the call. Like I say, you had a reputation, and you'd get a call. Can you do this show? Can you do that show? Johnny Carson came to McCormick Place one time, and Doc was the lead trumpet player, you know. So I got to play with him then. And, another person I got to know very well was Tony Bennett. Played with him a lot.
Yeah.
And he's a regular kind of guy, I'll tell you.
He seems like he's like just normal guy.
So talented, and, you know, and his voice is... I mean, he's what, 85 now or something like that?
Yeah, something like that, yeah.
And his voice just sounds great, you know. Always took care of himself.
Yeah.
And he never succumbed to the trends. In fact, somebody asked him why he sang all those old songs. And he said, they're not old songs, they're great songs.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? No kidding. In fact, when I have Joe Bell singing on this new album, a tune called What'll I Do, Irving Berlin. It was written in 1928.
Yeah.
I mean, and it's still a great song.
Well, and that's the thing, too. The American Songbook, they call it the American Songbook and all of this stuff. But, I mean, I was thinking about this the other day. It's like, you know, you look at the American Music Awards and everything else. But really, I mean, when you think about it, everybody knows. I mean, they would recognize, even no matter how old they are, they usually recognize Fly Me to the Moon, or they recognize, some old Gershwin tunes and things like that. I mean, in your opinion, since you've played this stuff so much, I mean, what is the difference between, like, the music that was written back then and the newer music, the quote-unquote, the contemporary jazz music, or the contemporary, you know, that style music nowadays?
Those were Broadway shows
that
these tunes came from. And there was a lot of those shows being written by the great composers that you mentioned, Jerome Kern, Harold Arlen, you know, Gershwin, and Irving Berlin, and on,
right.
Cole Porter, and so on. And not that there's great music being written all the time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, it's the chance for it to get heard and be popular they don't have the outlets like the Broadway shows were, you know.
Right, yeah.
Because that was, and also radios, too, you know, during those times, there were a lot of radio shows that would play those tunes and those, you know, with those performers.
Yeah.
Big bands that were, you know, like you're doing here.
Right,
you know, broadcasts, and they'd call them air shots and things. And from live from this hotel in the Blue Room in New Orleans, you know, and all these live shows. I used to listen to the radio all the time when I was a kid, and I heard a lot of this stuff, you know, and a lot of that disappeared. I mean, how many jazz radio programs do we have anymore?
Yeah, not a lot.
WDCB is about it.
Yeah. Yeah, but I mean, when you're looking at like the structure of the tune too, I mean, don't you notice chord change wise and you know, just the structure of a song from back then seems to be, I don't know, it just seems different than what they're using nowadays on some more contemporary jazz.
It things. Did have a structure called song form, which was AABA, you know, the A section and then the bridge, and then the other A section. Basically, that was a song form.
Yeah.
And it varied, of course, you know. I mean, they didn't expressly stick to that.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of the songs were written that way. You know, and each song had a bridge. And most songs had a verse to them that they sang on the Broadway show that introduced the tune. And like the tune Stardust, you know, has one of the greatest verses. Frank Sinatra just recorded the verse to that. He didn't even record the rest of the tune. That shows how great some of that music was, you know. and it stands by itself. But, you know, a composer like Billy Strayhorn, who wrote Lush Life, of course, and Duke Ellington, and there's a lot of great songs being written by all those great composers. Mm-hmm. But, like I say, there's still great music. There will always be great music being written, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Well, why don't we hear another great tune? Right?
Now, this tune is called Bahia. And
this is off of your
CD, the new one.
Oh, off the new one. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
This is a piece I played when I was 16, 17 years old. And I always remembered it. And I thought, I don't want to record that someday, you know. So this is what it is. It was written in 1938. And I got Paulinho Garcia to join us in Alejo Poveda, mm-hmm. you know, to make that stuff going, you know. And I told Paulinho just to, you know, go, you know. And he sings out the vamp. He joins us on the vamp with Pat and I. Mm-hmm. And then I let Pat and I go and let him continue on. So it's pretty wild, but the tune itself is a great song.
Well, let's take a listen to Bobby Lewis, Bahia.
Mm-hmm.
Here on Chicago Jazz Reveal, 90.9 FM, WDCB, chicagojazz.com.
Thank you.
All right, we're back here at Chicago Jazz Revealed. I'm Mike Jeffers, live at Katerina's.
All right.
We always encourage our audience to clap and scream. And there we go, see?
It's standing room only.
First thing first, we still have Bobby Lewis here. And actually, the question that I really want to find out, Bobby, let's talk about your golf score down in Florida.
Yeah. Let's see.
We just played in October for the first annual ChicagoJazz.com magazine. As
yeah,
a few of the
right.
golfers that we play with call it, ChicagoJazz.com
magazine. Nobody won, right?
Nobody won. No.
We all lost.
We got out of there alive. It was pouring rain in the morning. We gutted it out and made it happen. So you've got performances coming up on December 13th and 14th at Andy's, which is 11 East Hubbard Street in Chicago, from 5 to 8:30 p.m. And for those listeners that have never been down to Andy's, that's a great spot. Very easy. I always like to put this. It's like the parking alert here. It's very easy to park. You can go right next door to Shaw's, and they'll valet park it for $12, and you walk right in the doors. So you want to make things very easy for people so that they have no excuses not to come out. But, of course, Bobby will be there and his quartet. And then the Jazz Showcase, January 2nd through the 5th at the Jazz Showcase, Joan Wade Siegel's Jazz Showcase. And that is, 8 p.m. and 10 p.m., I think the shows are?
Right, mm-hmm.
And, of course, you can get all that information at BobbyLewis.com.
Right.
And find out when his new release is coming out that we just heard a couple of tracks from.
And there's actually a 4 p.m. Sunday matinee.
That's right, at the Jazz Showcase.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be the 5th, which is great, too, because, I mean, Joe and Wayne do that Joe's Save the Children performance, which is what he always calls it, the Save the Children performance.
Right.
So that's at 4
it's
o'clock.
It's great, really.
Well, and it's nice because, you know, a lot of times you can't bring, you know, underage kids out, whether they're 10 or whether they're 20. They can't get into a
right.
club.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, that's a great time to come out and hear a group, especially like Bobby's group.
Actually, you can bring them in at Andy's, too.
Oh, can
bring
you?
Kids in.
Because
mm-hmm.
it's a restaurant, so they can come
yeah.
in and,
mm-hmm.
as long
yeah,
as, they're with
as,
their
long
parents.
As they're with an adult, you know, with their parents.
Okay. So a couple final things. I mean, you know, you've been performing and really, I mean, you've done probably what a lot of the trumpet players listening to this broadcast would have loved to have, you know, been able to accomplish and do, you know, in music. I mean, recordings and you know, running a band and, you know, making money, hopefully.
Well, I guess I'm fortunate in the fact that I've done nothing but play trumpet
right.
for a living and a career. And, never worked a day in my life. If I had it to do all over again, I'd do it the same way.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. Well, that's what I was going to say is, I mean, what are you still teaching at all? Do you still get some students here and there?
Every once in a while. I don't pursue that.
Right. But, I mean, what do you tell, like, a younger student that's coming up that what are the most important things for him as a trumpet player specifically?
Well, I tell them I use the ABC method, and A is air. Mm-hmm. We all need air to breathe. If you're playing a wind instrument, you need air. And A is the first letter of the alphabet. Mm-hmm. So without A, without air, you don't do anything. And the B part is to blow the air out, you know, because if you don't do anything with it, what good is it?
Right.
You know, you're alive, but so it's A, B, air and blow, and the C is the corners that of your mouth mm-hmm. that form the embouchure, and they have to be strong, and they have to. So it's A, B, C. You know, and I tell them if you don't know your A, B, C's, you're not going to be a trumpet player. You know? And and B and C are nothing without A and
yeah.
all that, you know. So that's basically what I teach them, you know, the younger students anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And the other ones, I'll tell them just keep on keeping on, like Clark Terry says, you know.
Yeah.
Because nobody starts at the top. You have to, it's a long progression. I had one student come to me one time. He says, I want to be a jazz player. And I said, how long do you think it's going to take you? He looked at me kind of puzzled, and he said, 6 months? And I said, son, I said, it takes a lifetime to learn, you know.
Yeah.
And I said, it's a ladder. You take the steps up, you know. Mm-hmm. And if you reach the top, the only way is down.
Right.
So you never reach the top. You keep reaching. And at my level, I'm still on the first step as far as I'm concerned, you know. And then he says to me, what note do you start on? I thought, oh, boy. I said, who can I send this kid to?
Yeah, right.
I don't know if I have time to answer that question. You know. So anyway, that's what I tell students.
Yeah. Well, it makes total sense, too. You know, I think a lot of times that if you don't learn your ABCs, you don't learn your, you know, we talk a lot about when I talk to other musicians on the show, talk a lot about, you know, learning tunes and learning where that tune came from and, you know, why you should study the past so you can push through the presence and stuff. I mean,
learn the melody and learn the lyrics. Then you'll know the reason for the tune.
Which changes the whole way you play it, right?
Right. On my new album, I play Skylark. Mm-hmm. And I don't change one note. It's just note for note the way Hoagy Carmichael wrote it. And the rest is interpretation. Can you improve on Hoagy Carmichael's notes? I don't think so.
Well, why don't we take a listen to that as the perfect tune on the way out then, since you just brought it up.
It's the second track on
second
here.
Track, yeah. on the unreleased.
It's
Bobby
just
Lewis.
A duet with Jim Ryan.
Oh, that'll be great. And Jim Ryan's one of your longtime piano players and
good friends. Yeah, he played with my group years from 1988, 1989, something like that.
Well, that'll be perfect. So why don't we do that? It's great to have you on the show.
Well, thanks,
I'm really
Mike.
Glad
Thank you,
made
you
it.
So much. Really, I enjoyed it very much.
And, of course, you can get more information at bobbylewis.com. So let's listen to Skylark here. 90.9 FM, WDCB, Chicago Jazz Revealed, chicagojazz.com.